Welcome to History 101, Lecture 18, Nature and Numbers. From the changes in politics, the military and the law, effected by the French Revolution, let us now turn to four other elements that are basic to modernity, and of which we understand the most important one the least: global warming, demographic transition, environmental depletion, and industrialization, or, as you might equally call it, the entrance of humanity into the fossil fuel age. For the critical element of the Industrial Revolution was to replace water, wind, horse and manpower by power derived from fossil fuels, coal, and from the 1920s onward, oil. Archaeologists traditionally distinguish a stone, a bronze, an early, a high, and a late Iron Age. You might similarly speak of the modern era as the fossil fuel age, divided in turn into a coal and an oil age. Now, we understand the global warming least, because while man-made emissions of carbon do begin to kick in by the 1890s, the global warming of the previous period was not caused, or at least not mainly caused, by humans, although it is likely the mass logging and burning of forests in the 19th century did contribute to it. All we can say with certainty is that the sun may call through very long warm and cold cycles that are perhaps linked to solar spots, and those cold and warm cycles have defined human existence since prehistory, and they still define it. Now, as I said, from roughly 1300 to roughly 1720, the world went through a prolonged period of extreme cold, culminating roughly in the 1570s and ending somewhere around the 1720s. By far, most work has been done on Swiss glaciers, and this shows that the glaciers that had been steadily advancing over the last 400 years, where of course you were talking about yards and not about feet, began thereafter slowly to recede again. More work on glaciers in Chile, in the Himalaya, in Greenland, in Canada and in Norway has more or less confirmed this receding of glaciers was a global phenomenon. Although the problem with weather is that it is at once very local and global. With very much reserves, it may be said that since 1720, the world has warmed up by 0.7 degrees centigrade to the mid-20th century, after which this global warming began to rapidly escalate. This may not seem much, but there are enormous local varieties. For example, in Japan it has been estimated that the temperature from 1600 to 1700 was 2 degrees below that before and after. New Zealand data for the same period point to a temperature that was only 0.5 degrees lower, and in northern China 1 degree, while in Europe, from 1690 to 1720, temperatures were 2 degrees below average. The effects of this slow cycle of global warming may, it seems to me, well be deemed by historians. Looking back on the 19th and 20th century, from the year 2200, the most important development of those two centuries. They, after all, will then have to grapple with the effects of a runaway greenhouse effect that 99% of scientists are predicting is well underway already and can already no longer be stopped, nor, admittedly, do governments make much as exertions to stop it. But the effects of climate on history are very much contested. Humans, of course, like to believe they make their own history themselves, rather than that the weather or the interlocked ecosystem of planet Earth, that biologist James Lovelock called Gaia, makes it. However, we are simply an animal species reacting to its environment. There is no difference between us and whales or cockroaches. And very much in particular, humans like to believe that history is either made by great men or by some judicial and economic system. And very much in particular, they like to believe that the system that favors their own interest and their own group produces history. So too did historians, until not so very long ago. And this is the field to which big history has made a critical contribution, as it has encouraged both a long-term perspective and the perspective on human society, including human economy, as embedded within biology and ecology. So, looked upon in the very long perspective of big history, we are arguably still in a long economic upswing that is caused by the gradual warming of the climate, a long economic upswing of the sorts that have occurred in human history before, with economic and judicial systems that were surely very different from liberal free market capitalism, such as the economic upswing of the late Bronze Age, from 1400 to 1100 before Common Era, the economic upswing of the Roman Empire, the Maurya Empire in India, and China's Han Dynasty, that stretched from roughly 100 before Common Era to 300 Common Era. And last but not least, the great medieval upswing from 900 to 1300, which, just like our present economic upswing, featured a remarkable spate of technological breakthroughs and the rapid growth of trade within Eurasia, or indeed Afro-Asia, for it was very much built on imports of African gold, and material prosperity. A material prosperity that allowed for the building of Europe's great cathedrals, the vast temples of southern India, the great Hindu temples in Java, or Cambodia's Angkor Wat, and that began to unravel as the great cold and the drought set in after 1300. For in general, a warm period is more favorable to crops than a period with extremely cold winters, while increased melting of ice increases the amount of water available to agriculture. So the gradual increase in temperature caused an increase in agricultural yields and a massive increase in the amount of land under tillage, just like as happened in the late Bronze Age and in the medieval upswing. Thus in China, the yields of rice increased twofold from the 17th into the early 20th century, while new crops such as potatoes and maize were introduced. And by far the most important, the amount of land tilled in China grew from 33 million hectares in 1600 to 63 million in 1760 to 81 million in 1870, the most rapid growth in all of Chinese history. And most notably, it did so in the so far thinly populated hill tracts of southern China and in China's New World, Inner Mongolia and Jungaria. Again, as I've said, the theoretically fertile Black Earth or Chernozem region of eastern Ukraine had been, during the Little Ice Age, practically abandoned. It had turned scarcely populated steppe, populated by bands of wandering Tatar nomads. In 1720, less than 6% of the region was used as farmland. After the end of the Russo-Turkish War of 1768 to 1774, the region was annexed by Russia. And Russia started the policy of systematic colonization of the region it called New Russia. It is actually the part of Ukraine that has seceded from Ukraine last year. On the one hand, it tried to lure German colonists there, of whom finally some 11,000 moved to Russia. And on the other hand, it tried to encourage Russian colonists with rent-free loans and with free land, and with great success. Some 1.2 million people from Russia moved over the next 60 years into New Russia, and some 1 million acres of new land were brought in cultivation. By 1880, 40% of the region was used as farmland. The whole region became the granary of not merely the Tsarist Empire, but of Europe. Now, this had two major consequences to European history, which are commonly overlooked. On the one hand, New Russia became critical to the industrial development of Europe, as its grain fed the booming industrial cities of Western Europe. The USA only became a major supplier of grain after 1850. Yet on the other, Russian state revenues came to depend on grain. But all that shipping of grain had to be squeezed through a narrow bottleneck, the Dardanelles. And the Russian state thus had a vital interest in who controlled Constantinople, where obviously the Russians would have preferred to control the straits themselves. However, the British, and particularly the French, had a vital interest in keeping the Ottoman Empire afloat, as they had been conceded free trade there in 1832, and both French and British trade there were booming, and the Russians would likely throw them out. Here was the real issue of the Crimean War of 1852, where the French and British joined to defend the Ottoman Empire against Russia. The result of this expansion of land under tillage and slowly increasing yields was a worldwide increase in the population of societies organized in states, for it simultaneously witnessed a drop, as with the native Siberian and South African population, a catastrophic drop, as with the North American Indians, or the utter eradication, as with the Australian Aboriginals, of populations not organized in states, and of the populations of nomadic societies, besides, who were unwilling or unable to adjust to settled peasant societies swarming over them. The most dramatic increase of population was that of China, that grew from 85 million, though this figure may be underreported, around 1640, to 135 million in 1700, to 285 million in 1800, and then increased to 350 million at the end of the 19th century. But populations all over Asia were growing. That of Japan increased from 18 million in 1700 to 34 million in the mid-19th century and 60 at the end of it, and that of Java from 4 million in 1700 to 13 million around 1820 to 30 million in 1900, while India's population increased from 80 million in 1800 to 130 million in 1850 to 200 million in 1900. And all this, in spite of severe famines ravaging Asia, except Japan, in the late 19th century. Populations in the Middle East grew too, though not as rapidly as in Europe and in Asia. Anatolia had 9 million inhabitants in 1740. In 1860, it had 12 million, and in 1900, 15 million. The population of Egypt had long hovered around 4 million. In 1880, Egypt had 6 million inhabitants, and around 1900, it had 8 million. In Europe, population growth was even more dramatic. That of Britain increased from 16 million in 1800 to 27 million in 1850 to 41 million in 1900. Germany's population increased from 26 million to 35 million to 56 million. That of Sweden from 2 to 4 million, and that of Russia from 37 million to 213 million. And France's, finally, as I said in the previous lecture, the slowest growth of all of Europe, from 27 to 35 to 39. However, remarkably, this growth was not confined to the more developed parts of Europe. The population of Serbia rose from 1 million in 1800 to 3 million in 1900, and that of Greece, a staggering 750,000 in 1820 to 3 million in 1920. And all this despite mass emigration. The only exception to the rule of general growth all over Europe was the case of Ireland, where the combined effects of famine and emigration brought populations down from 5 million in 1800 to 3 million in 1900. South America's population as a whole soared from 9 million to 20 million around 1850 to 38 million at the end of the 19th century. But what I find particularly striking are population trends of the Caribbean. The population boom in Trinidad, from 40,000 to 200,000 in the 19th century, is explicable by and large by immigration from India. However, Jamaica's population increased from 300,000 in 1800 to 800,000 in 1900. And Jamaica, though it received some 30,000 contract laborers from India, probably lost far more people than migrated to it, as Jamaicans first sought work in booming and neighboring Cuba, and later on the plantations of United Fruit in Middle America. Yet, everyone was still outdone by the immigration countries. The United States population soared from 5 million in 1800 to 23 million in 1850 to 76 million in 1900. Australia, from some 5,000 whites in 1800 to 4 million in 1900. Canada's population increased from 2 million to 7 million. Brazil's population, another immigrant country, increased from 3 million to 17 million, and Argentina's population increased from 500,000 to 5 million. Clearly, population growth is somewhat related, but only somewhat related, to economic growth. The USA, Germany, or Britain were clearly booming industrial economies, and Canada, Argentina, Australia, or Brazil were booming resource export economies. Yet Russia, Java, and Greece, three other regions that were featuring a clear population explosion, were hardly in the forefront of industrial progress. And I think nobody in his right mind will put Jamaica or Trinidad in the fan of economic progress. While on the other hand, the very slow progress of France is particularly noteworthy. After all, France was surely a far more developed economy than Jamaica. Now, demographers generally distinguish three stages in what they call the demographic transition. In stage one, traditional society, death rates and birth rates were supposedly both high, and they cancelled each other out. Then comes stage two, in which the death rate drops and the population rapidly increases. In Europe, this demographic transition, according to the classical model, was supposedly initiated during the agricultural revolution of the 18th century. And these changes were initially quite slow. The decline in the death rate was, again according to the standard model, initially due to two factors: improvements in the food supply, brought about by higher yields in agriculture, and better transportation that prevented death due to starvation. And it was caused by a significant improvement in public health, an improvement that reduced mortality, particularly in childhood. These were not so much medical breakthroughs, but were rather due to improvements in water supply and sewerage. Though, admittedly, these improvements were overseen by the medical profession, and they were mostly laid out at their urgings. There were advances in the handling of food too, such as, for example, the idea that babies should be given clear water or cooked milk, and, in general, personal hygiene. And particularly, there was the diffusion of soap by the mid-19th century. A consequence of this decline of mortality during stage 2, according to the standard model, is an increasingly rapid rise in population growth, as the gap between death and births grew ever wider. Another characteristic is a change in the age structure of the population. Instead, one, the traditional one, the majority of deaths are concentrated in the first 5 to 10 years of life. Therefore, more than anything else, the decline in death rates in stage 2 entails the increasing survival of children and hence a growing population. The age structure of the population becomes increasingly youthful, and most of these children enter the reproductive cycle of their lives while maintaining the high fertility rates of their parents. The bottom of the age pyramid widens, and that accelerates population growth in turn. Now, this model is surely not wrong. There is massive statistical evidence for it. Yet, it has to be considerably modified. Basically, there were 5 different demographic patterns in the 19th century. The first one is the immigration pattern, typical of the USA, and the precise reverse of it in Ireland. The population of the USA exploded because it received 23 million immigrants, of whom 6 million were Irish. They were mostly younger people from 20 to 30, and they sought to found a family as soon as they had found a job or had established a farm in the USA. Immigrant societies in general are short of women, so the women marry young and the children then arrive by the bushels. In the USA, fertility of marriages remained high until the 1870s, as was the case in Australia. The Irish pattern was the precise reverse. The Catholic Irish had traditionally had more children and larger families than the British or the Germans. But after the famine, almost all young people left Ireland. So the Irish population, in a way, no longer exploded in Ireland, but rather in the USA, or in Australia, or in Canada. Some 50 million Americans and 3 million Australians are nowadays of Irish descent. It is hard to even imagine how an Ireland with some 70 million inhabitants would have looked like had they all stayed in Ireland. Possibility 2 was that fertility and mortality both declined at the same time. And that happened in the unique case of France. Immediately before the French Revolution, France had one of the highest birth rates in Europe, 36 births per thousand. By 1850, that had dropped to 26, whereas in England, over the same period, it was 35 and 36. One consequence of this was that by 1850, France had a relatively elderly population, and that was one major reason for its relatively sluggish economic performance in the 19th century. Possibility 3, and that is the one commonly stipulated by the demographer, was that mortality declined before fertility declined, as happened in very well-studied Sweden. Indeed, the whole model is derived from Sweden, where child mortality began to decline by 1860, and mortality in general by 1890, while the number of children per family remained at 2.4 until the early 20th century. The same happened in Belgium or in the Netherlands. The Netherlands are a bit atypical, however, in that families continue to have quite large numbers of children up to the 1950s. Possibility 4 was what happened in Britain, in Germany, and in Italy, and to some extent in Russia, though, as we saw, the Russians were exceptional in always having had large families. Namely that from 1780 onward, couples abandoned the previous European demographic pattern, married younger, and mothers gave their children breastfeeding for lesser time. In other words, British and German and Italian population growth was primarily due to an increase in fertility, as was, but for completely different reasons, the case in Jamaica. 4. And this is why the rapid increase of the population of Jamaica is so puzzling. There was very little or no state-provided medical care in Jamaica at all. Indeed, medical care may have dropped after the abolition of slavery. For before 1832, plantation owners were required to allot some minimal medical care to slaves. After the abolition, only some very basic medical care was provided by the missionaries. And there is no proof whatsoever hygiene for the population was improving. In fact, Victorian observers constantly stressed how the Jamaican peasants were living in unbelievable filth. So, the standard demographic model does not hold at all in the West Indies. As I mentioned before, the West Indies populations had before the abolition of slavery a tendency to constantly drop. The population shrank unless being replenished by new slaves from Africa. Yet after the abolition, it began to grow rapidly. What seems to have happened is that before the abolition, women had very few children, both because of the grueling work they had to do on the fields, resulting in many miscarriages, and as they wanted few children. After all, they weren't even sure their children might not be sold to another plantation. But as slavery was abolished, and most former slaves abandoned the plantations to put up subsistence farms instead, the women wanted more children, as every child on a subsistence farm is an additional hand. This has not been investigated for Jamaica, as far as I know. But investigations into the budgets of subsistence farmers in Russia showed that the poorer farmers were generally the ones with less than 2 children. So, and this is the problem with the classic model of the demographic transition, it fails to take perhaps the most basic thing in any demographic model into account, namely whether women want children. Instead, it tends to deny agency to women and it seeks for some outside agency, the medical profession or the state. This is, of course, unavoidable, since the state and the medical profession leave reams of statistics behind, and demography is a branch of mathematics nowadays. While whether a woman wants a child is a personal decision that leaves little statistical trace. Yet, even contemporary evidence indicates that the wish of the woman to have a child is the critical factor, because there is still a very clear statistical correlation between the number of children and the number of years a woman has gone to school. Basically, if a woman follows an education, she has on the one hand to delay pregnancy until she has completed her education at, say, 25 years. For it is of course very difficult to study if you have to care for a baby the whole time. Well, furthermore, many women then want to pursue a career. And it is again very difficult to spend any time on anything but your children if you have more than two. A dramatic case in point of that correlation is modern Iran, where up to the 1970s, women had on average four children, and there was very little education for women. Only some 200,000 women then went to school. Now, the Iranian Revolution of 1979 made education its absolute top priority. And since 1979, the number of people receiving secondary education has soared from 2 million to 18 million, of whom 40% are women, whilst the number of students has soared from 20,000 to 300,000, and the number of women outnumber the number of men in universities. Women, we may assume, follow an education in university in the hope of making a career. Now, over the same period, the number of children has equally dramatically dropped to only 1.9. That is below replenishment rate, so that Iran's population will begin to shrink from 2030 onward. Precisely the same applied to Europe as well. The fertility per marriage, a few oddball exceptions such as the Netherlands excepted, began to decline precisely at the point of introduction of obligatory education for females in around 1890 in most European countries and in the USA and Canada as well. That was the age too in which the first women were admitted to universities. Nor is it likely a coincidence that poorer regions in Europe, such as southern Italy, continue to have much higher fertility than northern Italy right up to the 50s, since there was very little education for women there. However, the striking oddball case of the Netherlands points to yet another fact. The Netherlands continue to have striking high fertility unto the 1960s because of the continued influence of the church in the Netherlands, a church that pressed the believers to have as many children as possible. It is very likely the same is the case for the Greek population explosion and the Greek Orthodox Church. In the USA, native-born whites had smaller families than immigrants. Protestants had smaller families than Catholics, and rural people had larger families than town dwellers. In other words, religion and economics played a major role in demography as well. Thus too, the Russian Orthodox Church insisted on the faithful having as many children as possible. Until the 1950s, Russians had always large families, and then the numbers suddenly began to drop. This has clearly several reasons. Mass education for women, for one, and urbanization. But one major cause may well be the secularization of Russian society over the same period as well. While the trend in far less secularized Soviet Central Asia was the precise reverse. Their family sizes were actually growing from the mid-50s onwards. Demography is very much conditioned by gender, by economics, and by culture. And this brings me to demographic pattern 5. Now, as said, pre-industrial societies have always followed population policies. One way was the European demographic pattern where, as we saw, people would marry late in life. Yet there are other possibilities, such as that women may have few children because of infanticide or abortion, or that the number of marriages would be limited by large numbers of women or men remaining unmarried. Now, while people in China married younger than people in Europe, the number of children per marriage appears to have been roughly comparable to that of Europe, 6 children per marriage, against 7 in Europe. This was partly done by abortion and partly by sexual restraint in marriage. It's a pattern that is particularly well documented for the Manchu nobility. Married nobles with a lot of land had more children than married ones with very little land. As the women did not have that many children, the central mechanism which Chinese society traditionally used to curtail the growth of population was to prohibit men to marry. Males were only permitted to marry if they could maintain their wives by having sufficient land at marriage. And since many men of lower status did not have land, this meant that large numbers remained unmarried and childless. Now, and here's the point, if more land was being brought into cultivation, more men had land to get married. They had children, and so the Chinese population began to explode by 1700. In other words, in the Chinese situation, demographic growth was not driven by decreasing child mortality or by decreasing death rate, nor by more children per marriage, nor by an earlier age of marriage, as rather by more marriage. Now, there are broadly two ways of conceptualizing the impact of population growth on economic development. The first way, I alluded to already, was pioneered by Thomas Malthus in his Essays on the Principles of Population. Economic growth, according to Malthus, causes population growth. The population then increases more rapidly than the economy, and it eats up any economic gains that have been made previously. However, it is then commonly next said that once that magnificent system of free market capitalism was introduced in England and in the USA, humanity, for the first time in history, managed to escape out of this nasty Malthusian trap. As the growth of productivity of agriculture now allows production to grow faster than population. Now, that productivity of agriculture increased in the 19th century is undeniable. In England, for instance, by a very rough estimate, average productivity of land growing grain was around 1,310 bushels, and on the very best land it was 20. In 1800 it was on average 20, and on the best land 30, and the productivity then increased to an average 30 in 1900 and 50. Northern France, Belgium, the Netherlands and Denmark all caught up with English yields of 1800 around 1850. Western Germany did so by 1860, Eastern Germany by 1890, but the Balkans, Russia, Spain and Portugal all still lagged far behind. In Spain in 1900, the average productivity of land was the same as in England in 1300, and in Portugal it was below that at 9. Yet, there is a major problem with that argument. While English and French and Dutch and German and Belgian agriculture had all admittedly far better yields in the 19th century than before, The reality still was that all those countries with rapidly growing population had by 1850 to import ever more grain from the United States, from Canada, from New Russia, and by 1900 even from Australia and India, and that the only country which still grew enough grain to feed its own population was France. In a term introduced by Swedish biologist Georg Borgström, Western European countries increasingly relied on ghost acres. That is, the economy of these countries exceeded the human carrying capacity of their land, and they got away with that by drawing on invisible carrying capacity. Their agricultural production was reallocated elsewhere. Borgström calculated in the 60s that India and China were then for 99% self-sufficient in food. Of course, China no longer is, and India very soon will not, and that is going to reshape the entire geopolitics of the 21st century. Yet in the 1960s, Britain relied for half of all its foods on imports, the Netherlands for full 70% and Japan for 40%. While if we would factor in the coast acres producing for exports to elsewhere, most African countries actually produce far more food than would be needed to feed their populations. In other words, looked upon from Borgström's perspective, Malthus may have been right. At the very point at which he had more or less expected it, in the 1830s, as it abolished the Corn Laws that had so far protected British agriculture by draconic tariffs, England, and surely Scotland, began to run out of food. England had been a net exporter of grain in the late 18th century. By the 1880s, it was world's largest importer. That looming crisis of agriculture was thus solved by buying ever more food abroad, and indeed by procuring ever more vital or even all vital materials from abroad. English demand gave rise to monocultures of cattle in Uruguay, in southern Brazil or in Argentina, sheep monocultures in New Zealand and Australia, coffee and tea monocultures in Sao Paulo or in Ceylon, as historian Clive Ponting put it. As the United Kingdom became industrialized, it began to draw upon raw materials from ecosystems abroad, subjecting them to monocultures, to simplification of their ecology, and to deterioration of their ecology. That is why England so tenaciously clung to its empire in the Victorian era. In Europe as a whole, the early 20s of the 19th century had been years of hunger, and this was mainly compensated by growing ever more potatoes. Indeed, arguably, the potato saved European populations from an approaching Malthusian crisis, as the poor came to rely on a monotonous diet consisting of potatoes, and yet more potatoes, and bread became an expensive luxury. Potatoes, with a little coffee and tea added, was indeed what the poor in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe and in Russia, ate by 1880. The famous painting by Van Gogh, The Potato Eater, is typical for a transformation of European diets away from bread, cheese and meat towards potatoes, with a few vegetables added, and very rarely cheese, and meat perhaps once a month. Very similarly, Italy shifted to another poverty dish made from an imported American crop over the same period. Spaghetti made from mice. In 1845, 1846 and 1847, however, the potato harvest all over northern Europe failed due to a disease, the potato blight, and food prices soared to 2 times the price before. However, authorities in Europe, unlike those of the United Kingdom and Ireland, of course, just barely managed to avoid famine by purchasing grain in Russia and the USA. Yet, as food prices had soared, this obviously meant people could spend less on other things. And this caused mass unemployment. This ushered already in riots in 1847, and then in 1848, practically the entire continent of Europe exploded, except significantly Britain, that already imported most of its grain, and Russia, that was a net exporter. Basically, then, from 1850 onward, Europe avoided a Malthusian crisis by purchasing ever more grain from coast acres abroad, which it could do because, on the one hand, from 1850 onward, the plains of the Canadian and American prairies, as well as the Argentinian and Uruguayan pampas, were brought into cultivation, and later on, from the 1880s onward, South Australia and even the Punjab in India. Until the 1870s, India had hardly exported any grain. By 1910, it supplied nearly as much grain to Britain as the USA did, while in India itself, meanwhile, 10 million people perished in famines. And on the other hand, this was possible due to consecutive improvements in navigation under steam. So the costs of transport overseas dropped. In 1860, it cost 6 sterling to fetch a ton of grain from Chicago to Liverpool. In 1900, it cost 4. By 1920, that had dropped to 3. The other way of conceptualizing effects of population growth on the economy has been pioneered by Danish economist Esther Boserup, who did research in India at the time everybody assumed India was the classic Malthusian case of population outrunning resources, the 1960s. Boserup then argued that rather than that increasing food production would cause a growth of population, the precise opposite was the case, namely that population pressure would cause an increase in food production, as it provided an incentive to intensify production by applying more fertilizers to the land, by applying more water, by growing more productive crops, and by increasing inputs of labor on the land, or simply by working longer hours on the land. The more the pressure on the land increased, the more productive people became. Boserup argued that both 18th century England and 17th century Netherlands, or 17th and 18th century Flanders or Venice, appear to vindicate her model. Agrarian productivity there increased together with the population. While there is a lot to be said for that model, there are 3 problems with it. The first of which Boserup well realized, but the other 2 she did not address, or rather merely skimmed. The first problem is that there is a standoff between increasing land utilization and increasing labor productivity. Simply put, with heavy population pressure, peasants will work ever longer hours on the land. But there is a point where you simply can't work longer hours anymore. You have to eat and sleep after all. And this point appears to have been reached in Chinese agriculture by the mid-19th century. Though the productivity of rice could still be somewhat raised by ever more input of labor, by 1800 the Chinese agricultural system began to get stretched to its very limits, and then it slowly began to break down. Sinologist Mark Elfin, in a classic study, called this a high-level equilibrium trap. The productivity of agriculture was already quite high, but the only way it could be further raised, argues Elfin, was by more inputs on a very advanced stage of industry and technology, that is, an industrial and scientific revolution had to precede a further growth of agricultural productivity. Yet there was little incentive for that, as the peasants were already toiling day and night at near starvation level, and they could thus buy very little. By 1900, the average Chinese peasant could afford to buy one pair of new clothes every 4 years, and a new pair of shoes every 3 years. Perhaps most striking for the crisis in Chinese agriculture, in the 18th century, the Qing state, or the Manchus, had with great difficulties managed to avoid major famines by centrally stockpiling rice. In the 19th century, the whole system broke down. There were at least 15 major famines in China, in which at least 50 million people died. In addition to that, late imperial China was suffering from severe problems with soil exhaustion, with erosion causing severe floods, and with deforestation. As one poet then put it, quote, "In times gone by, our forefathers managed here plowing. Then countless hoes chopped the hill. Then the hill came down. We eat grass now to stay alive. One meal of grass for many people is many, but grass is in short supply." China was admittedly not much more overpopulated than Britain or the Netherlands, yet it did not have coast acres. If famine threatened, the Chinese government could not as easily procure grain in Canada or in the USA as the British one might have done, since nobody was going to sell things to a government that had a tradition of perpetually defaulting on loans. Second, Bosrup more or less only skimped the arguably most critical issue, namely the division of land, and that is very much a class issue. In Sicily, for example, like in Europe throughout, the population exploded from 1 million in 1700 to 3 million in 1900. Now, as we saw already, Sicily was traditionally a bastion of landlords and landed estates. But as during the Revolution, governments all over Europe had abolished feudalism, the Bourbon dynasty in Sicily declared feudalism abolished in 1806 too. And the government announced peasants could henceforth freely acquire land. Yet, as the small peasants had no money to buy land, what actually happened was that most was bought up by rural speculators, who were mostly from the former landlord class, so that large landholdings actually increased after the abolition of feudalism. At the same time, after 1850, more and more Russian grain became available. Sicily could not compete with that. So the market for Sicilian grain collapsed. And while the Bourbons announced they would stimulate the market for luxury crops and wine, they had no money. The unified Italian state later on did not want Sicilian competition to North Italian products, while the landlords were not interested in improving their estates. Thus, the net result of population growth in Sicily was to produce fast, empty, abandoned latifundia ran by absentee landlords, which produced little, and masses of poor peasants on very small plots of land, eking out in utter poverty. Those peasants had basically by 1900 to subsist on remittances from either America or from Sicilian laborers in northern Italy. By 1900, 70% of the peasants in Sicily had insufficient land to subsist on. Third, the location of a place matters, or more precisely, the location of a place within the capitalist world system matters. The common pattern in a colony was that all the best land was reserved for plantations, and that peasant agriculture turned to a mere labor reserve for plantations. And this was already fairly typical for the post-emancipation of the slaves Caribbean. Thus in Jamaica, the former planters, some 8,000 people, remained in complete control of the politics on the island, as the former slaves were completely excluded from the vote. On the declaration of abolition of slavery, the planters had not only been generously compensated for their forfeited property, their slaves, by the British taxpayer to the tune of 20 million sterling, but the former slaves had also been forced to stay on the sugar plantations as so-called apprentices for a period of 8 years. For the colonial authorities said, they still had to learn the benefits of the free labor market, so they were admonished by the governor of Jamaica to become respectful proletarians, just like any worker in a British factory. As follows, quote, "It is your interest to be civil, respectful, and industrious. Do not mistake in supposing that your present houses, gardens, or provision grounds are your property. They belong to the proprietors of the estate now, and you will have to pay rent for them, in money or in labor." Not only was there obviously still a whole lot of ill will between former slave drivers and former slaves, but the result of all that was that the slaves still owned absolutely nothing, not even their own former garden. Under slavery, they had been more or less free to cultivate it, and it was seen as their own property, and the planters paid poorly or commonly did not pay at all. It was nothing exceptional for ex-slaves not to receive any pay for work for half a year. So, as that apprentice period ran out, the former slaves all abandoned the plantations in order to establish their own farms in the difficult hill and mountain country of Jamaica that had not been cultivated before and was therefore nobody's private property. Yet, as nobody would give them any credit, they could not buy any agricultural implements, and so they had to work their land with the most primitive wooden house. At the same time, because of competition of still slave-produced Cuban sugar and sugar beets, sugar prices in England halved. For together with slavery, the British Parliament had also abolished the protective tariffs on sugar. A few planters, admittedly, tried diversifying away from sugar. But most had really no idea what to grow but sugar. The result was that plantations went bankrupt by the dozens, but that the small peasants had no money to buy any of their land, and they were strictly prohibited to move onto land that was not their property. Consequently, by 1880, the pattern in Jamaica was the typical colonial pattern: abandoned plantations occupying the rich coastal plains of the island, next to an ever-increasing population of dirt-poor peasants who occupied the mostly hilly and infertile lands on the island. Now, this population growth has had two further consequences in Europe and in densely populated parts of Asia, such as Japan. First, a double mutation of the attitude towards nature. On the one hand, Europeans had up to the 18th century perceived nature as a dangerous or hostile force that was to be combated or avoided if at all possible. About the worst thing which could befall you was to be left alone in a forest, an abode of dangerous animals as much as of dangerous people. In the 19th century, however, the feeling increasingly became that, quote, we need the tonic of wilderness. At the same time that we are earnest to explore and learn all things, we require that all things be mysterious and unexplorable, that land and sea be indefinitely wild, unsurveyed and unfathomed by us, because unfathomable, we can never have enough of nature, as David Thoreau wrote in a classic, Walden or Life in the Woods. It's indeed a great American classic, so nobody in the USA reads it anymore. And yet, the Occupy Wall Street movement might have profited from it. For nature became ever less dangerous, as in the course of the 19th century, all unspoiled nature in Europe completely disappeared. A few remote corners of the northernmost Scottish Highlands, northern Sweden and Norway, and Iceland excepted, including all those nasty animals that had populated those forests. Wolves had disappeared in Western Europe already by the late 17th century, and in Eastern Europe they became a rarity by the 19th. The bear population, of which there had once been hundreds of thousands, shrank to a few thousand in all of Europe. There are presently, for example, some total 6 bears in the Alps and 70 in all of Italy, who are carefully fed by the state as old age pensioners. The savage wilds were either replaced by industrial forestry that dates back to the 18th century, but by the late 19th century included virtually all forests of Europe, and all with their own carefully regimented lines of trees, or it was replaced by carefully built up park landscapes that were so constructed as to resemble nature, with, for example, those carefully indicated paths for the casual walker, from which the casual walker is not allowed to stray, lest he be fined by the park ranger. And that is the typical pristine wild nature of Europe nowadays. Or again, nature was converted into tourist attractions. This first happened nationally, and by 1840, William Wordsworth could already bewail all the tons of litter left behind by casual visitors to England's Lake District, and then by the late 19th century internationally. Switzerland could by the late 19th century receive 1 million tourists yearly. Following the invention of mountaineering as pastime in the mid-19th century and then skiing in the 1890s. Aside from into tourist attractions, nature was converted into game reserves for the very, very wealthy, as for example happened in the Scottish Highlands, where, as the population was evicted by the clearances, fast tracks were being converted into game reserves, where the very, very wealthy could then engage in the noble art of deer stalking before shooting those deer. An odd sport first popularized by Victoria's consort Albert. The magnificently antlered stag, as historian Maureen Martin puts it, about to meet his death, embodied everything that was tragic about the Highlands, so that deer stalking allowed upper-class Englishmen to re-enact their nation's victory over Scotland. Yet, above all, nature was now buried under a new industrial landscape of smoke-belching factories, railroads, and suburban development. Thus, England's formerly richest agricultural region, Middle Essex, has completely disappeared on the London suburbs. By 1820, there were already complaints that because of all the filth thrown in the Thames, there were no salmons in the river anymore. And there were by 1830 protests as well against all the effluent filth of collieries and lead mines. And indeed, reckless tin mining in coastal Cornwall in the 18th and 19th century has left a permanently scarred landscape behind that the British, with a keen eye to publicity, have recently managed to get on the UNESCO World Heritage List as a unique case of an early industrial landscape. Similarly, the Irwell River flowing through Manchester was once famed for its trout fisheries. But by 1840, everything in that river was dead. For indeed, London journalist approaching Manchester in 1840 could already write, 40 miles away from Manchester already, quote, "The tall chimneys begin to figure conspicuously in the landscape. The country loses its fresh rural appearance. Grass looks brown and dirty, and foliage is stunted and smutty. Footpaths across the fields are black with coal dust, while factories and mills raise their ponderous masses everywhere." Can the River Thame, flowing through the capital of heavy metal industry, Birmingham, was in the 1840s described as stinking horrendously, and for most of its course it is covered with thick white scum from which a noxious effluent is exhaled. And by the 1850s, farmers in the neighborhood of Birmingham were complaining that all the fish in the river was dead and that cattle refused to drink from it. And finally, nature was submerged under commercial farming. In 1800, William Kilpin in England could already complain that, quote, Wherever man comes with his tools, deformity comes in his wake. His spade, his plow, and his hatchets make shocking encroachments upon the landscape, while the regularity of the cornfields disgusts. One of the earliest cases of a protest about the destruction of landscape wrought by agro-business. There had already been a kind of proto-environmental back-to-nature movement during the Enlightenment, famously pioneered by Rousseau, where famously too, readers of Rousseau, Queen Marie Antoinette and her ladies-at-waiting, could then play the peasant woman in a carefully recreated peasant cottage in the gardens of the Palace of Versailles. However, the 18th century's idea of nature was still that of a carefully tendered garden. But as threatening and dangerous real nature completely disappeared below industrial landscapes and agro-business, there was an increasing movement to preserve what little was left of nature. The Bird Preservation Society of Britain was founded in 1852, for example, which was very necessary too, because by 1900, hundreds of bird species in Britain had already become extinct, and it was later on expanded to a bird preservation society for the entire empire in 1900, and that was very necessary too. 4. From the United States, Thoreau could already write about Walden Forest, near Concord in New England, when I ponder that all the noble animals have become extinct here, the cougar, the panther, the lynx, the beaver, the bear, the moose, the turkey, and so on, and so on, and so on, I cannot but feel that I live in a tamed, emasculated country. It is as if I think that I have here an entire poem, and then to my chagrin, I find that it is only an imperfect copy that I possess. For simultaneous to the new appreciation of wilderness also came an ever more ruthless commercial exploitation of and assault on the wilderness. After Riego's revolt in Spain, for example, the new liberal government started to sell off land owned by the church and by the military orders to private investors, mostly merchants, who saw this as a possibility for rapid gain. This included virtually all forest land in Spain. All over the country, this led to reckless logging or ignorant plowing, causing massive destruction of subsoil. Again, in Italy in the 1860s, most land in possession of the state and the church was privatized, including half the Italian forests, from which the bourgeoisie most profited by buying that land, after having first passed the laws that allowed the privatization. It all led to wholesale clearances, whereas in Russia, by 1890, engineer Astrov, in Anton Chekhov's novel Uncle Vanya, could say, quote, "The Russian forests are crushing down under the axe. Billions of trees are perishing. The habitats of wild animals and birds are being laid to waste. Rivers are getting shallower and drying up. Wonderful landscapes are disappearing, never to return. The climate is ruined. And with every passing day, the land is becoming poorer." Very similarly, Canada's forests were in that period more or less appropriated by lumbering companies, which saw the forests as the green gold. Those companies first built a sawmill, the lumberjacks employed by the company then felled the very best trees, and then they moved on and put the rest on fire. In fact, the entire economy of the province of British Columbia was built on thus recklessly burning the forests and exporting its woods to the world market. Its present main city, Vancouver, was hardly coincidentally built on the site of a sawmill in 1853. Yet nothing even approached the massive deforestation of the USA in the 19th century, so much that it well may be a major factor in the warming of the 19th century. For, argued British businessman Adam Hodgson, while to the Englishman a forest evoked the idea of shelter, rural beauty, to the American every acre reclaimed from forest was one further conquest of civilized man over uncivilized nature that would allow the country to stretch her empire up to her furthest limits. It is likely that 2 centuries of pioneer endeavor up to the beginning of the 19th century had succeeded in clearing 100 million acres of forest. By 1860, that had risen to a staggering 39,700 million acres. Part of those forests were lumbered to make place for farms. Most, however, were logged to provide charcoal for iron working. They were burned in engines for steamboats. They were used for locomotives, or they were used for lumber for houses. And yet, nothing as clearly sums up the environmental destruction wrought by both the USA's unfettered capitalism, its manifest destiny, and indeed the devastation that industrial society wrought on nature in the 19th century, a devastation that was to become of global scale in the 20th century, as the utter destruction of the American buffaloes of the Great Plains. And that is worth a long quote. When, wrote Colonel Charles Inman in 1892, I look back only 25 years and I recall the fact that the buffaloes roamed in immense numbers, I ask myself, have they all disappeared? An idea may be formed of how many buffaloes were killed from 1862 to 1881 by the following estimation. In Kansas alone, there was paid out, between the dates specified, $2,500,000 for buffalo bones gathered on the prairies to be utilized by carbon works of the country. That required 100 carcasses to make 1 ton of bones, the price averaging $8 a ton. So the above quoted sum represents the skeletons of 31 million buffaloes. Those figures may appear preposterous to readers not familiar with the Great Plains a third of a century ago. But to those who have seen the prairie black from horizon to horizon with those shaggy monsters, they are not. In the autumn of 1868, I rode with General Custer for 3 consecutive days through 1 continuous herd that must have contained millions of buffaloes. In 1886, the Union Pacific Railroad and its branch to Kansas was nearly completed across the plains, and that year witnessed the beginning of the wholesale and wanton slaughter of buffaloes, which ended only with their practical extinction 17 years afterwards. The cause of this hecatomb of animals on the Great Plains were the incursions of regular hunters into the region for the hides of the buffalo and crowds of tourists who crossed the continent for the mere pleasure and novelty, the latter class killed for the excitement of the new experience, as they rode along in the cars at a low rate of speed. The former, numbering hundreds of old frontier men, all experts shots, with thousands of novices, pioneer settlers on public domain, day after day, for years, made it a lucrative business to kill buffaloes for the robes alone, a market for which had suddenly sprung up all over the country. On either side of the track of the two lines of railroads running through Kansas and Nebraska, within a relatively short distance, and for nearly their whole length, the most conspicuous object in those days were desiccated carcasses of noble beasts that had been ruthlessly slaughtered by thoughtless and excited passengers on their way across the continent. On the open prairie, miles away from the course of legitimate travel, in some places one could walk all day on dead bodies of buffaloes killed by hide hunters without stepping off them to the ground. And so, with the killing of the buffalo by careless slaughter, hunters and tourists together converted a landscape that had most resembled the African Serengeti to either endless empty grasslands or empty monotonous crane fields, the kind of landscape that nowadays typifies the American West. And with that, they killed the Plain Indians, who entirely relied on buffaloes for food. So the inhabitants disappeared with the buffaloes, and they were to be replaced by European immigrants. So the Kiowa, for example, said, "The buffaloes were the life of the Kiowa. When the white men wanted to build farms or railroads, the buffaloes protected the Kiowa. And so the white men decided to wage war on the buffaloes. They built forts and they hired hunters who had nothing else to do than kill buffaloes."